Okay, I think Corinne's working on it. I'll let you know. You're broadcasting now, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm calling this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue to order. It is Thursday, January 21st. Welcome, everybody. To everyone listening in, as well as to all the members with us, I wanted to make just a couple of remarks before we introduce everybody. For everyone listening in, legislators may be in their office upstairs, and you, members of the public, could be a few blocks away or a few hundred miles away. I want to spend just a couple of minutes now setting the stage for our meetings, since we're not going to be together in our usual place, which is here. Room A is present in Hearing Room A, helping to broadcast for us. This will be, in some ways, like the traditional meetings that you are used to so much as possible if you've attended Revenue Committee meetings in the past. You will see us, the committee members, and Legislative Revenue Office economists on the screen instead of in our usual places, the chairs at the table in Hearing Room A. But one of the drawbacks for you and for me, too, as chair, is that we can't always see everyone all at the same time due to the way the images are displayed on the screen. If someone is calling in on a phone versus on a computer with a video capability. I assure you, it's not ideal for us either. We used to be used to scanning the table and seeing everyone there, and also scanning in the audience to see all of you. And you could tell when we're present or when we get up for a minute. You can see the staff doing their work at their desk. It's not ideal not to be able to see that, take that all in one view. Committee members, when you want to speak, please use the raise hand feature. But as we get used to that, or as we find it does or doesn't, if I haven't noticed someone, I've already spoken with our vice chairs. The vice chairs will just let me know verbally that there is someone who's asking to be recognized to speak. And that's perfectly fine. If there is a technical glitch, please be patient. In a Hearing Room A meeting, we occasionally stood at ease or paused the meeting while we figured something out, dealing with some sort of meeting process issue. So we'll do the equivalent here. It may happen from time to time that we decide that we need to stand at ease once in a while, but that will be, again, no different than we normally would have when we met together physically in the Hearing Room A setting. And similarly, just as you would see in a regular meeting when we were physically present, occasionally someone needs to excuse themselves for just a couple of minutes. There's some personal business they need to take care of, and they will be away from the chair for a couple of minutes. So they will turn their video feed off, and then they will return quickly, just within a few minutes. And again, that's no different than might have happened in Hearing Room A. So please feel free, committee members, if you need to get up for a couple of minutes, that's fine. Just as you would have in the Hearing Room. Now, in the Hearing Room, sometimes you would pass me a note to let me know you needed to be gone for 3 to 5 minutes, or there was something else, you were testifying on another bill. We will work out a mechanism to exchange information about that in the future meetings as we figure it out. Okay, well, let's get started. I am so happy to see the returning and the new members today. Let's start off. Chris, will you or a committee assistant please just go down a committee roster and call on us, and then people can say something just for a minute or two about who they are, the district they represent, and if there's another minute of something they'd like to say, that's fine, so that we can all get to know each other and the public who may be watching can see who we are.
Sure, Madam Chair. So we can start with Representative and Vice Chair Pham.
Great. Welcome. Thank you, everybody. My name is Khan Pham, and I represent Oregon House District 46, which covers parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland, including the J District, where I live, as well as Pelhurst-Gilbert, Laurelhurst and Mount Tabor, Lentz and Foster Powell.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Thank you, Chris. My name is E. Werner Reschke. I'm the House representative for Southern Klamath and Lake Counties, and been on revenue. This will be my fourth tour of duty, two as a member, and this will be my second as vice chair.
Rep. Hernandez.
Hello, everybody. I'm Representative Hernandez. I represent House District 47, which is Outer East Portland, between Mall 205 and Rockwood. And this will be my third session on revenue.
Rep. Levy.
Hi, everyone. I'm Bobby Levy. I represent District 58, most of Umatilla County, all of Union County, and all of Wallowa County. Thank you for having me.
Rep. Marsh.
Thank you. I'm Pam Marsh. I'm the House Representative for District 5, which is Southern Jackson County, just above the California line. Excuse me. Rep. Reschke and I actually share a common boundary. So we are your Southern Oregon representatives here. With that, I think I'll stop talking.
And Rep. Smith.
Thank you. Howdy, folks. Chris, first of all, it's really good seeing you. I look forward to when we can meet in person. So my name is Representative Greg Smith. I live in Heppner. My district is District 57, which includes the other half of Representative Levy's Umatilla County, starting in Milton Freewater, going through Hermiston, over into Morrow County, Gillam County, Sherman County, and the very best parts of Wasco County. You know, I don't know how many terms I've served on revenue, but I've been here for a while with Rep. Nathanson, and I look forward, Rep. Nathanson, to your chairmanship and serving with you.
Thank you.
So now if we turn to the staff of LRO, this will give all of the members, especially new members, hopefully if the tech cooperates, at least the ability to lay eyes on our staff members. We have five economists and an office manager and three committee assistants. So we'll just kind of go down that list and have everybody kind of identify themselves and their areas of specialty. So if we could start with Mazin, I think you're here.
Yes, I am. My name is Mazin Malik. I'm of course, legislative revenue. After serving 10 years with the Department of Transportation, I came to legislative revenue in 2002. So, you know, you've been here, we've seen me around. I do a number of topics and issues. One, the largest of which are probably the transportation area. And transportation area includes all kinds of different sub areas, highway, DMV, public transit, light rail, heavy rail, marine, aeronautics, passenger rail, and a few others too. Also, in addition to transportation, I do other taxes and fields and issues. I do your alcohol, both distilled spirits, beer, wine, cider, seltzer, so on. And to go on with the other OLCC issues, I do also your marijuana, you know, taxes, distributions, revenues. Probably also this committee would deal with issues of marijuana as well as the transient lodging tax. This is the hotel motel taxes and so on. Do also issues like energy, electricity, PUC issues, environment, DEQ, and bottle bill, bonding, bonding and debt finance for general fund revenue, bonds, higher ed, so on. And finally, I do also court fees, penalties, fines, and those types of things that had to do with Department Judiciary. And in general, whatever else of overall taxation, state and local taxes, that kind of wraps my portfolio.
So the other senior economist is Dave Beck.
Hi, Chair Nathanson and committee members, Dave Beck. I do school finance and a part of sin tax, cigarette tax. And then I do a provider, medical provider tax and some other things. But I support our boss so that he can succeed. Thank you.
Next, we have Kyle.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Easton with Legislative Revenue Office. I've been with the office since 2014. The areas I cover right now are the personal income tax and then also the tax credit review process. So as part of that review process, you may see me in some of your other committees as well as those bills work their way through the policy committees and then eventually come into the revenue committees or the joint tax credits committee as well. So nice to see you all again and nice to meet the newest members as well.
And then we get to some of our newer economists. Jamie McGovern, she was having some technical issues with her camera. Are you there, Jamie?
Can you guys hear me? I don't know. Okay, yep. Great. So hello, Chair, members of the committee. This is Jamie McGovern. I don't know if you can see my video. I
yes.
can see myself. Okay. I work on property taxes and timber taxes or forest-related taxes. I also work on estate taxes and some sort of 911 taxes, cell phone taxes, broadband, things that we think of as communication taxes. And happy to be here. Nice to see you.
And then our newest economist is Kate Harger.
Hi, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. I am Kate Harger. My areas are primarily in corporate taxation, as well as the new cap tax that was passed in the 2019 session. I also do things related to broadcasters and opportunity zones, and I've been with the office since December of 2018. So this is my third session. Thanks.
So then we have our office manager, Corinne. She may not be able to. She may not
light.
Have a mic.
See, I don't think they can see me.
Okay.
I'm muted. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I don't think you can see me. Anyway, this is Corinne. I handle all issues with our bills and moving the bills through the committee and supervise the assistants who you're about to meet. And I've been with LRO since 2008 and with the legislature since 1998. Nice to meet all of you.
And so our committee assistants, those who are familiar with the office in the past when we're the building is open and operating under normal conditions. We'll have one committee assistant per committee, and then we have a receptionist. This time, given the circumstances, we actually have three committee assistants, so that for every committee, we'll have two people staffing it, and we're going to kind of have a rotating rotation. So the first of the three is Donita.
Hi, can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. My name is Donita Bruce. I am new with LRO as of 2021, now that we're there. I'm new to the legislative process in Oregon, but I'm very happy to support the House Committee on Revenue in any ways that I can. But it's nice to meet everyone.
And then we have Manny.
Hello, everyone. My name is Emmanuel, but I go by Manny. I'm a recent grad at UO, and I'm excited to be here and see how the legislative process would go by. And yeah, thank you for having me.
And next is Haley.
Hello, everybody. My name is Haley Bell. I am new here as well. I come from OED and DHS. This is my first session, and I'm really excited to be here. So thank you for having me.
Okay, Madam Chair, I believe that's the...
Great. Thank you. And for a couple of the new members especially, or for the staff who don't know me yet, I will mention that House District 13, which I represent, is primarily North Eugene and downtown Eugene. And occasionally we have a little bit of lighthearted banter in a committee conversation. And without intending to start any rivalries between the orange and green yet, I do need to mention that my district includes Autzen Stadium, the home of the Ducks. We have completed the first item on our printed agenda, the organizational introduction, member and staff introductions. That was the organizing part that leads into, we will now have a work session. So I think that means I'm officially opening a work session now to adopt committee rules. Mr. Alanak, will you please start this agenda item for us?
Sure. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So if one of the committee assistants could pull up the House rules on the screen, and while they're doing that, there have been a number of changes to the rules since the 2020 session, mostly having to do with the virtual meetings. So I was just going to touch on a few of those differences. Or maybe it's easier for me to share my screen. Okay, I think that's coming through. So the first item, the quorum, is that there's a roll call here, and with members identifying whether they're here by audio or video. The main change in the second rule is just to clarify that a suspension of the rules can happen by a two-thirds vote, and the rules can be amended by a majority vote. The meeting agendas are largely the same. There is some changes here around the time limit, given as we're going to figure out how we move forward here with the time limit and how the committee operates during public hearings with the committee. The next items, the subcommittee is different, but that doesn't really pertain to revenue. The voting on motions has been modified just by this sentence: a roll call vote shall be taken and recorded on any question. The next change is 9 here, it's just a technical change in spirit. The prior version had language around meeting minutes, and that really isn't done. It's via this recorded log. Then if we roll down to number 11, there was just a technical clarification for the minority report deadlines and clarifying that it's the second business day after giving notice for the due date. Another tweak on the minority reports, so the minority report topics, the word house here has been added. So rather than just within 24 hours of a first public hearing, it has to be a first public, first house public hearing. And then the next change is really a moving of this statement here. The only written amendments prepared by the Legislative Council may be considered by the committee. That used to be down here in number 15. It just got moved up to number 14 to streamline number 15 so that it just refers to the impact statements. So that's just a quick read through of the changes.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments from committee members?
Could we see those? I'm sorry. Could we see were the rules sent to us by email?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I will be reviewing it on my inbox.
You can also find it. This is a good process issue for the committee. It's also pretty easy to find them if you are on OLIS and click on today's meeting of the committee. There's a tab for meeting materials, and they will be posted there. So that's really good for public notice, so all the public has access to everything. But because it's public, then it's a real quick way for us to also have access to the materials. So there will be a tab that says meeting materials.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions or comments? Chris, I'm sorry I didn't ask you this before, but I've certainly wondered it, and it's throughout rules for all committees. It's not just revenue. Why is it important that when we give our verbal response during a roll call to make a quorum, that we distinguish between whether we're video or audio only?
I believe my understanding is that it's all trying to be as transparent as possible and just being clear why some part of the intent is if to be to the extent possible, people members are participating by video and that the cameras are turned on. However, there are members for various reasons who will only be able to participate via phone. And so it's to make that partially to make that distinction.
Okay. Yes, I was in a committee meeting earlier this morning, an 8 o'clock meeting, and one of the members explained there is no internet access from that member's home. It just isn't there, thus proving the point about not only broadband access, but just any internet access at all. And that is not in a remote area. In, let's say, eastern or southeastern Oregon. It's actually a pretty close-in area. It's just due to topography and other issues and whether carriers are interested in providing access. There just isn't at that location where that one member lives. Any other questions, comments? If not, I would like to entertain a motion, and sometimes it's pretty typical for a vice chair to make routine motions, but I'd be happy to entertain a motion to adopt the committee rules.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the committee rules as written.
Thank you. Representative Reschke moves adoption of the rules. Any discussion on the motion? And Mr. Alanak, in these rules, is it permissible within the rules if I start, if I would start with, are there any objections? It can move things along much more quickly.
I believe so, yeah. I don't see why that would be a problem.
I'm going to ask the members of the committee for things that appear to be routine, such as this. Is it all right if I start with something that's a little less time-consuming and say, are there any objections? If I hear no objections, then we won't go through the roll call.
I think we still need to do a roll call vote. I think it would still be safer to do the roll call vote.
All right. Well, I was just trying to help us move things along, but we'll move right to a roll call. Thank you.
Representative Hernandez?
Aye.
Representative Levy?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh votes aye.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham?
Aye.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Aye.
Chair Nathanson?
Aye. So at this point, since everything is much more formal than before, do I wait for committee staff to announce whether the motion had sufficient votes to pass?
We can do that, yes. You had, yes.
To me, it certainly seemed like it was unanimous. Motion passes. We've adopted our committee rules. Thank you for that. It will get a little bit easier, but we'll still go through this process of roll call for everything we do. I'm closing the work session. I am now opening an informational meeting. Revenue overview. And before we do this, I wanted to mention this is particularly for the new members of the committee. You probably got a little bit of this when Mr. Alanak was talking about both committees. Interesting to keep in mind is that our staff is staffing not only the House Revenue Committee, but the Legislative Revenue Office serves both the House and the Senate. And there's a Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. And the economists who you met today and Mr. Alanak, they are committed to working, answering questions, staffing meetings for both committees. So sometimes it might make it easier in a way because they can prepare the same background information for each committee, but they still have the responsibility of all the members of both committees and the public and all the bills that are assigned to both committees. So that's a lot on their plate. They're always managing that. And Mr. Alanak, would you please remind us what your time obligations are for attending these hearings when we're scheduled, when our meetings are scheduled?
Oh, okay. So the House Revenue is scheduled on Monday through Thursday. Mondays and Wednesdays, it's at 1 o'clock. And Tuesdays and Thursdays, it's at 3:15. And just so you're aware, the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee is either immediately following this committee or immediately before. So we have Revenue Committee meetings between 1 and 5, Monday through Thursday. On Monday, the order is House Revenue and then Senate Finance and Revenue. And that's that order for Monday and Wednesday. And then Tuesday, it's flipped where we have Senate at 1 and House at 3:15. So that's the time frame. So we're going to be pretty busy during those afternoons. And that for the newer members, that is different from prior years where we would have one of the two committees generally at 8 a.m. and then the other committee at 1 p.m. So we're going to be doing some adjusting in our office too.
It also sounds to me from seeing the description of when they're scheduled, there will be long periods of time, a half a day every day, when at least some of the economists and Mr. Alanak are not available for just getting the regular work done, such as preparing briefings, doing the economic analysis of bills and so forth. But they will be staffing a committee for basically 4 hours nonstop. Okay, so now let's have the LRO overview to start us off for the year.
Okay. So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So depending on the committee makeup from year to year, depending on kind of a newer membership versus a veteran membership, we have different kinds of orientations. And in talking with the chair, the way we're going to run it here at this point is I'm going to provide a very high level overview of Oregon's revenue system without getting into the details or the mechanics of any of the individual taxes. And then I think next week we'll have some orientations or overviews on the income taxes and property taxes. And then other topics will probably come up as related bills come up, just to give especially the newer members some additional background information on the bills and the tax policies that you'll be dealing with. I did want to point out there is a lot of information on our website. So under the legislature's main website, under Capital Offices, you can click on LRO and then publications. And there are a variety of publications that we produce. One of the main ones that is really a handy 101 document, if you will, is Oregon Public Finance Basic Facts. And we update that on an annual basis. And we intended to have it uploaded today, but we ran into some technical issues. So I think we're going to get that uploaded over the next day or two. And I'll let you know when it is. And it's a compendium of almost all of the taxes in Oregon. So it doesn't go into a whole lot of detail about any particular tax, but if you want to pull up something about the marijuana tax or the property tax, it's a good place to start for, okay, I don't know what I don't know kind of thing. Let me read a few pages and some really, we kind of try to keep it true to the name, Basic Facts. So that is on its way. And so with that, I am going to try and share my screen. Okay. So the idea here is just a very high level, as I mentioned before, just to touch on the broad revenue sources that are available to the state and some of the fun terminology that gets used. I have a couple of slides on that. And then I have a handful of slides on state comparisons. One of the common questions we get on any policy is, what do other states do? Sometimes it'll be our neighboring states, what does Washington or California do? But what do other states do? And this information comes from the census, and there are advantages and disadvantages to this information that we'll get into. But there are a handful of slides that try to give a sense of where Oregon stands in relation to other states from a public finance perspective. And then the last few slides are on the kicker and reserve accounts. I always get, almost in any presentation I get questions about the kicker and the reserve accounts. So the start here, as we're easing into the session here and getting up to speed and dealing with some of the technical and complicated policy issues that will be before you, is really to lay some foundation and context for Oregon's public finance system. And I would encourage anybody to chime in with questions. I don't know that I'll be able to see them, but as they come up. So focusing for the state, so for 21-23, we have what is referred to as an all-funds budget. Now, these particular figures, it's about $100 billion, and this comes from the governor's budget. And it's a combination of a projection for 21-23 as well as whatever policy changes she has suggested in her budget. And what jumps forth here is there are really three or four main buckets when we talk about funds. And the largest one is actually other funds. And this deals with things like transportation taxes, unemployment insurance taxes. All of those are part of the other funds. Federal funds is the next largest, and that's the federal money that the state draws down in one way or another. And then the final two slices, we have the general fund and the lottery. And that's where a lot of the debate is, because that is really the pot that the assembly has to spend as it sees fit. The general fund is obviously the larger of the two. It's projected to be about $22 billion in 21-23. And the lottery funds are about $1.5 billion. And some of those lottery funds are dedicated, but a good amount of that is available for other spending. Here's just an enumeration of some of the...
Excuse me, I saw a hand up.
Yes.
I think Rep... now it's disappeared. Rep Rushke. Vice Chair Rushke, did you have a question?
I did. Madam Chair, may I ask it now, or do you want me to wait until the end?
Sure. I was looking at the top and didn't see it on the bottom. Thank you.
That's all right.
Go ahead.
I'll make it wave next time or something. But Chris, when I look at other funds budget there, that seems larger than it has in the past. In the past, I've kind of pictured in my mind a third, a third, and a third, with other funds being a little heavier than a third. But this is almost at 50%. What is the cause, I guess, of that? Is it the CAT tax? Is it something else, or have I'm just curious what might be the reason for this growing in proportion to the other slices?
Vice Chair Reschke, yeah, I think it is a number of things. The CAT tax does show up in there. On the order in 21-23, that is going to be about $1.5 billion, maybe $2 billion of that 46. So that is in there. But I think it's just a number of smaller issues like that. Transportation taxes show up there. And with the transportation package that was passed in 2017, that could be contributing to that. And marijuana would also be in there. So there are some of the newer sources that are helping that to grow in size a little bit.
Thank you.
Yes, and I can't see any hands, so please feel free to interrupt. And this is just an enumeration of the same information where you can see the taxes here. Now, this is the combination, again, taken from the governor's budget. So total taxes from the all funds, it's that $100 billion split out here. So taxes, general fund, and other funds is about just under $34 billion. And then the federal is about $30 billion. And then interest earnings comes in third. This does include interest for the state's retirement system. And then you get a various list of other items that total up to the $100 billion. And again, this is for 21-23. Turning to the general fund, we see that and this will be a familiar story for returning members, the general fund is mostly the income tax. 88% of it is the personal income tax. And the corporate income and excise tax is about $1.3 billion. And I think you'll be getting some detailed information on those next week. But the takeaway here is that between those two, that's about 94% of the general fund that is the income tax. And there are advantages and disadvantages to the income tax that we'll cover as we go through this.
Madam Chair and I noticed that Representative Smith has his hand up.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Chris, can you go back a slide? Can you share with the committee what constitutes donations and contributions?
Well, to my understanding, those are, I don't know a lot of detail on the on what they're made up of, but they are various, I think, just donations to the state and local governments. It could be things like donations to colleges and gifts to universities, those kinds of things.
Yeah, awesome. And so I guess what I would anticipate is that those, for the most part, are one-time events. If they're going to a university, perhaps it's Mr. Knight making a donation or a landowner donating a ranch to OSU or something to that effect. But that, if we could get a little clarity on that in the future, that'd be wonderful.
Yes, I think you're right that it is kind of one time, but I will get some more information on a detailed breakdown and get that back to the committee.
Awesome. And with that, I would assume, and this is the Ways and Means part of me, those one-time events also are going to have very specific uses with requirements that would come with them, I would assume. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and that's a good point. A lot of the all funds is an attempt to get at the full picture, and the general fund has fewer strings attached. The federal dollars and the other funds usually have strings attached on how that money gets used. Getting back to the general fund, we have other taxes of about $600 million. This includes, for example, some tobacco taxes, and the estate tax are a piece of the other taxes. And the other revenue, about $800 million, includes some liquor apportionment and some fines and fees. And here is a table just for, now this is for fiscal year 1920 for local taxes. And what you, the takeaway here is how reliant local governments are on property taxes. Far and away the largest contributor to the local finance system. This slide is a history of the income and property taxes going back to the early 70s. And we can see some of the takeaways here is that going up until we hit the 1990s, property tax was a larger contributor to the revenue system than the income tax. But going from about 1990 to the middle of the 90s, this is the phase in of Measure 5, which was passed around this point. It phased in. And then we had Measure 50 come into play here. And since then, for the most part, the property tax has been less, and it grows at a more stable pace than the income tax. With the income tax, you can see where we have these periods of strong growth, and then we hit a recession. So we have growth through about 2000, and then we hit the 2001-2002 recession, and then we hit strong growth again, and then we hit the Great Recession here for 2007-2009. And then since 2010, we've had very strong growth up until recently. Now the drop here, and each of these drops also, this is after the kicker. So the kicker impact is embedded in these collection numbers. This drop here, in part, it does include the latest kicker, but there's also an anomaly here around the timing of the income tax payments. Given the events of 2020, we had an extension or a moving of the filing deadline for income tax returns from April of 2020 to July of 2020. So a chunk of this, and I didn't have time to break it out or break out an estimate actually, is that some of the income tax collections that we would have seen in quarter two of 2020 actually moved to quarter three, and that moves it into the next fiscal year. And that's also part of the reason here with the corporate income tax drop as well. But it's helpful to keep in mind, just in the back of your mind as you're having discussions and thinking of policies, the magnitude of the dollars here. So the personal income tax were around $10 billion a year, and the property tax were at about $7 billion a year, and the corporate were give or take, we're approaching $1 billion.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It'd be interesting to see population, correlation between population growth and these numbers, and also number of registered businesses in line with these, just to see if the growth is also consistent with population growth.
Sure, we should be able to add that. I can make that change and get an updated version back to the committee.
And Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, just a quick question. In the personal income, the orange line here, the personal income tax, does that include pass-through income or pass-through entities? So are we seeing S-corps and LLCs numbers appear in the personal income tax section and mostly just C-corps in the corporate income tax? Is that how that breaks out?
Yes, that's correct. The corporate, to answer your, and kind of backwards or yeah, reverse order, the corporate income tax, these are the C-corporations. So these include the large multi-state, multinational, as well as some smaller C corporations, but that's kind of the key lingo here, is that these are the C corporations that are subject to the corporate income and excise taxes. And we'll get into this a little bit later over the next few days or next week. I label it corporate income tax. There are actually two taxes, but I think Kate will get into that in a little more detail. There's an income tax and an excise tax. Right. For all of the non-C corporation businesses, all other forms of business, they pay tax through the personal income tax. And a rule of thumb for the amount of tax that they're paying of this orange line is about 10%. Mm. Now, this includes businesses, the ones that you mentioned, Vice Chair Reschke, your S corporation shareholders, your partners in a partnership. So rather than the partnership and the S corporation paying the tax, if there are three people in a partnership, the income for each one of those partners that they report on their individual return shows up here, and that the personal income tax that they pay on their piece of that business income. It also includes sole proprietors, and LLCs are also mostly showing up here. LLCs can actually file as any other business type. LLCs are what we refer to as creatures of the state. So when an LLC has to pay an income tax or fill out an income tax form, there isn't a federal form. So the LLC chooses to file as a C corporation, S corporation, partnership, or sole proprietor. Most of them, to my understanding, file as a partnership. So the takeaway there is the vast majority of the number of businesses pay tax through the personal income tax. Rule of thumb, it's about 10% of whatever this number is. And then C corporations pay the corporate income excise tax.
Thank you.
And I'd like to follow up with one more question. Since you commented that timing is responsible for some of the severity of the dramatic dip in revenue, because taxes that would have been filed and paid in the second quarter were then postponed to the third quarter. Is there a way of smoothing this line chart in the future as we get past the next quarter or two? So rather than seeing a dramatic drop and then maybe a little bit quicker rise than normal, you make account for it and smooth it a bit.
Yes, I can. we can make that change. It changes the nature of the graph rather than here's the history of the collections by fiscal year, and it involves an estimation piece. Because I can certainly look back and say, okay, well, these were the personal income tax collections in the second quarter and what they are in the third quarter, and then base a smoothing, if you will, adjustment based on historical relationship between the Q3 and Q2. But I can certainly make that change in the future.
I can see that someone may not want it to be a permanent change, but here's what's on my mind. Some of this information is very, very important. It's related to what you might commonly call cash flow. It is about receipts, what revenue is being received when, and how that impacts how government does its business. It's related to not only budgeting, but just operations and how the money is being received. From a more general economic point of view, if it was money that was owed for that tax year and it finally came in, I think that's a different kind of point that we would want to know. Well, how much was owed for the year and how much did come in, rather than a cash flow from quarter to quarter where you're watching it that way. It's just generally how were Oregonians or taxpayers contributing contributing to the revenue in this way for a particular either tax year or calendar year. But it's looking at it from two different points of view for two entirely different purposes.
That's a good point, Madam Chair. And that's always important as consumers of information and statistics to keep in mind what a graph tells us, or more importantly, what it doesn't tell us, and how assembling it can affect the interpretation.
Thank you. So now that we've led you down some other paths for a few minutes, I think you can move on to the next slide.
Sure. This one is also we'll have that similar kind of blip here in the most recent year. And this is a relationship between the property and income tax burdens historically. And it takes the income tax collections, and somebody requested some information kind of normalized by population. This is taking the property tax and the income tax and dividing it by personal income. And that's a slightly different calculation, but that's one way economists and stakeholders talk about what is Oregon's tax burden. So if we start with the property tax, if we go again pre-1990, the property tax is collected, when you take the amount collected and divide it by personal income for the state, it was, very roughly speaking, close to 5% a year. So in terms of a tax burden aspect, it was about 5% of personal income. Then we have Measure 5 phase in through the first half of the 90s. And then that 5% burden really fell down to about 3%. And we have a blip up here, and that's, again, due to, it's kind of a data anomaly related to the Great Recession, as incomes really fell and the property tax, which is more stable, didn't fall as far as personal income. So as a percent, it crept back up to about 3.5%, and then has been working its way back down to what appears to be a longer term normal of about 3%. And the income tax has grew up until the 1990s, and for the past 20 or 30 years, we've been bouncing around 4%. And everything that was said about this drop applies here. I can certainly make some assumptions and make an estimate here so that it doesn't drop off as far, because I would expect in the next year it could be bouncing back up, and then we have two data points that are kind of a joint anomaly. So I'm kind of pausing a second because I can't see anybody, but.
I don't see any hands raised. Oh, there's something, but I can't tell who it is.
Madam Chair, I see Rep. Pam Marsh has her hand up.
Okay, I can't tell who it is. It's on the plus 13.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I think that the problem is I logged in as a visitor because I'm on another computer. So we're just making life more complicated for you. I do have a question about this chart. So we saw that property tax plunged because basically property tax was capped except for the 3% allowed growth. Mm-hmm. And we know that local governments lost out when that happened. And at the same time, the income tax, while it's fluctuated, has remained relatively level. So is what we're really looking at here a loss of government revenue generally to state and local governments that's sort of represented by that plunge? We didn't make up that property tax from any other source.
I think that's a fair assessment. Viewing and it can be a little counterintuitive, viewing the property tax through this income tax data normalization really, I think, highlights some of the stability. So one of the advantages of the local system is it relies on, it's stable, broadly speaking, relying on property values, but it doesn't bounce back when income grows. And with the general fund and the income tax, one of the advantages there is that in good times when income really grows, then the income tax goes with it. And it doesn't have that same cap, to your point, around the Measure 5 limits.
Thank you.
Okay, the next handful of slides is comparing Oregon to other states. And the best, if not only, information for this kind of comparison is the census data. So one of the advantages of the census data is it's easy to access and we can make these kinds of comparisons, and it provides a very high level view of how Oregon compares to other states. Some of the drawbacks are it is a couple years old, so this information, the 2018 census data, was just released, I think it's September. So this is the newest that's available. So as I go through these, it's important to keep in mind that this information does not include any changes made in 2019 or 20 by any state. So it's really looking back to 2018. From a data overview perspective, and I apologize for throwing so many numbers at you, but that's the nature of the Revenue Committee in many ways. And I laid it out this way just to provide some sense of what is being presented versus not presented in the next few slides. So this first column, if you will, total revenue for 2018 was just about $60 billion. And the way census divides that up is that you have general revenue, you have utility revenue, liquor revenue, and insurance trust revenue. And the different states handle these differently so that there are still awkwardness, or there still is an awkwardness in making some comparisons. But the comparison that I'm done here is really trying to focus on what we refer to as own source revenue. So if we take the general revenue and we divide that between own source revenue and federal dollars, this is the intergovernmental transfer from the federal government. And there are a number of policies that states can enact to draw down matching dollars. So if the state spends, collects taxes and spends it in certain ways, it can be a policy choice to draw down more federal money. So the state has some control over that. There are always strings attached to the federal money, but it is a way for the state to add additional revenues to the spending mix. And then the own source is what we refer to as the state taxing or imposing fees and charges on itself. And this own source is broken up into taxes, which is about 2/3 of the group and the largest amount. And then you have charges and miscellaneous. A couple of examples for charges. I tend to think of education as being the easiest one or the best example of what a charge is. And miscellaneous, that's where lottery revenue shows up. And just the insurance trust just to touch on that briefly, is it different? It's not in the mix here, given the nature of taxes that are imposed that go into these insurance funds, you know, whether it's unemployment insurance or the family medical leave insurance program that will be starting next year. So the focus here on the next few slides are these highlighted, I don't know if that's orange, or I'm not sure what color that is actually, for these categories. So by way, to put some historical context on this, in 1990, again, this is prior to Measure 5, looking at these four categories, you have taxes, federal dollars, charges, and miscellaneous. 54% of the state and local pie, if you will, came from taxes. 20% was federal drawdown, and then we had 13% for charges and miscellaneous. And some of the ideas to think about how these differ is that taxes are compulsory payments that go into a pot, and the legislature spends that accordingly. And charges are something that individuals arguably benefit from because they're paying them charge for something that they want. So if we go from...
Would that include, for example, a vehicle license?
Yes. Yeah, that should be in charges.
Mm-hmm.
So going from 1990 to 2018, we can see that there's a change in the relative sizes of the pie slices. Taxes went from 54% down to 45%. And the biggest growth there would be charges, went from 13% to 21%. And then federal actually grew at a healthy rate too, from 20% to 25%. And then miscellaneous fell from 13 to 19. That's kind of a default. So at a very high level, Oregon from 1990 to 2018 moved away from taxes as funding the majority of the state and local system to focusing and enhancing federal drawdown and charges. Now, when we compare that to all states, kind of the mythical average state for 2018, that state actually looks a little more similar to Oregon in 1990, where the average state in 2018 relied on taxes for 54% of the state and local budget, if you will. 22% for federal, which is a little bit less than Oregon. And for all of the other pieces, it's going to be less. So charges are at 17 and miscellaneous 7.
Okay. Representative Reschke, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, so I understand that the size of the pies are the same for visual purposes, but I have to assume that the pie in Oregon for 2018 is significantly larger in size than it would be for 1990, and therefore the 45% that are just taxes in real dollar amounts is probably, my guess would be, significantly more than the 54% back in 1990. Are those assumptions correct, or am I making an error somewhere?
I think that's pretty fair. Yeah, this is just on a percentage basis. So the state and local dollar amount in 1990 is going to be a good bit less than 2018. We're talking 28 years, so almost three decades.
One of the things that I find pretty interesting is other states are relying, in this comparison, trying to compare apples to apples, other states are depending more on taxes as a proportion than Oregon is. And Oregon seems to be working harder or qualifying more somehow for drawing down the federal funds, which, if I recall, in a way, contributes to our export economy, because to the extent that we bring federal money to the state, that money recirculates in the state, thus helping support economic activity in Oregon. So it would be interesting at some point to hear someone talk about how it is that we're doing better, if you consider it better, I do, at drawing down federal funds. But that looks like a not insignificant difference.
You can't see me, Madam Chair, but I'm taking notes about that.
Thank you. So,
So the next comparison is a per capita comparison. And over the couple of slides here, most of these comparisons, I mean, we just had a kind of that the traditional pie percentage comparison, but we have the issue of how do you compare the state. So, you know, the joke or saying about once you've studied a given state's public finance system, you understand one state's public finance system. And extrapolating that to other states, there's always interest in that, but it's always tricky and challenging. One of the ways that we are able to make these comparisons is to take the collections and divide them by the size of the economy, if you will, the size of the state. And one of those is just taking dollar amounts and dividing by the number of people in the state, the population. This is the per capita. Another possible way to do that is to take those same dollars and divide by personal income. It's a way to try and normalize the data. It's helpful in that sense, but it is limited in the sense that it doesn't really account for some of the policy decisions made by the state legislatures on how they want to spend money in one area versus the other. So I would just ask you to keep that in mind in trying to understand what is and is not represented in these charts. So with that said, for the state and local revenue system, in 2018, all of those revenue sources combined per capita for Oregon was just over $11,000. And the average state was just over $10,000. So in terms of that, the money being raised, Oregon is more than the average state. But if we look at the breakdown for the four categories, and we can see where that those differences occur. The red bars are taxes. So here we could see that on a per capita basis, 2018, Oregon state and local taxes were just under $5,000 a person. And the average state is around $5,400. And then for federal dollars, and in some ways this tells it's just another way of telling that story on the prior chart. Federal dollars per person, about $2,700 compared to about $2,300 for the average state. And then charges, $2,400 for Oregon, $1,700 for the average state. And then rounding that out, the miscellaneous is a little bit closer, where Oregon's is 1,000 and the average state is 700. So that provides, you know, one other piece of insight as to where revenue lands on the debates around a high tax state, low tax state, and how does that fit with the notion of a high spend or low spend state, if you will.
Madam Chair, this is Rep. Marsh, if I could.
Hi. Yes.
Just a couple of observations there around these comparison charts. I think first it's significant that the additional federal money that we are getting is about half of that price, that total differential between the 11,000 and the 10,000. My guess is that a whole lot of that federal money is due to our ability to engage with the federal government around healthcare and to pull in significant matching dollars for Oregon Health Plan. And I think the other observation here is, again, if you harken back to that chart, the lateral chart that goes back to and shows the progression of property tax and income tax over the years, is that what we are seeing as property tax is capped in particular at the local level, is a shift to charging for things. And that's it is not surprising when we really have had, until the CAT tax, two significant sources of funding, and that state and local governments have turned toward the assessment of charges and fees just to be able to make those budgets work.
I think that's correct.
There's also a point to continue the point that Representative Marsh is raising. Charges or fees are paid by the person consuming that particular service, rather than taxpayers in general paying for a lot of programs and services, whether they use that particular one or not.
Yeah, that touches on a couple of notions within public economics. Is the ability, you have an ability to pay principle, and you have a benefits received principle, where an ability to pay is, generally speaking, those individuals or households with higher income pay a higher share or pay more in tax, versus the benefits received principle, whereas those who are benefiting from those direct functions are the ones who pay. And we see that that's reflected in the shift for the points that were just made about moving from general taxes to the charges and fees. Back and forth between those two principles.
Yeah. Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to also ask a little bit more about these charges. Do criminal justice fines such as bail, court fees, probation fees, are they included in the charges? In which case, yeah, I just wanted to clarify if they always include things that people are paying for benefits of, or what's included in these charges, and checking the assumptions about what's included.
I'll do some double checking. I don't think the fines and fees are included in this, but I will have to double check and get back to you on that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like that might be the only place that it, we'll see. Thank you very much.
Did we just have a technology glitch, or was I the only one who noticed it?
I didn't notice anything on my end, Madam Chair.
Okay, Mr. Allenak's response froze for a minute, and I had a message pop up on my screen that there was some sort of difficulty, but maybe not everyone noticed it generally. Thank you.
Okay. So the next chart dives into a little more detail on the taxes. And here, the bar chart on the left is the per capita comparison. So that 49.59 and the 53.92 would look familiar from the prior chart. And here, it's looking at the tax makeup for Oregon versus the average state. And you can see where Oregon's tax structure, and I think this will be kind of obvious to people. The income tax, so while Oregon's overall tax burden per capita is less than the average state, the income tax is much larger than the average state. So that those red bars at the bottom, the income tax per capita for Oregon is around $2,100 or $2,100, yeah, $2,100 versus $1,300 for the average state. And kind of in the numbers are listed here. And one of the key takeaways from here, I think, is comparing the income and the sales tax. As everybody knows, we don't have a general sales tax. So if we look at our income tax, it's about $2,100. And if you look at the average state, if you combine the income and the sales tax, that's about $2,600. So in some ways, the income tax is replacing the combination of the general sales and income tax. The property tax is fairly similar. We're just on the a little bit below average. And the other thing that comes out here, other tax, you have selective sales taxes, which is about the same. Now, if we look at the tax burden as a percent of income instead of per capita, we're closer to the average. The average state is about 9.9% in terms of taxes divided by personal income, and Oregon is at 9.7. And on a personal income tax basis, we're remarkably similar to states for all of these categories. I mean, the property tax is both 3.1%, and then we're reflecting the per capita numbers, the Oregon income tax burden is about 4.2% of personal income. And for the average state, that's split, in, give or take half, about 2.3%, 2.4% for each of general sales and income tax. Now, I'm expecting this will change once we're able to incorporate the corporate activity tax. The way the census organizes its data, I suspect, and I don't know this, we'll have to see when we get to this point, is that the corporate activity tax will start to show up as general sales. And part of the reason for believing that is that the Washington's B&O tax shows up under general sales tax.
As we move to this slide, I'd like to do a quick time check with the committee. We have about, I think, 25 minutes before we get to the end of our assigned committee hearing time. At this pace, we should do fine for completing all of the slides. We have up through slides 24, about 8 more slides. But just wanted to let the committee know that we're now in sort of like the last period for this hearing.
So this slide is just state taxes. And on the left there, we have the average U.S. state. And so it's not local taxes. So most property taxes tend to be local taxes. Some states do have state property tax. But on the left, you get kind of, you get a sense of how the average state relies on general sales and personal income tax. And for Oregon, we almost regularly are the state that relies the most on a single source of revenue. So for Oregon here in 2018, 70% of state taxes was made up of the personal income tax, so that heavy reliance on a single source. And then oftentimes the state that comes in second is Washington, and their reliance is on the general sales tax. Now that is a combination of a retail sales tax and their B&O tax. And then California, you can see, also has a heavy reliance on the income tax. And Idaho is a system that we often, that economists generally will describe as a balanced system, where you're getting equal amounts of general sales tax and personal income tax. That way you're, it's kind of a diversified portfolio, if you will, where depending on the time and nature of recessions, you get some strong growth from the personal income tax in good times, and then you get some stability from the general sales tax when recessions hit. This is another area where I would expect Oregon will have an orange bar from the CAT tax in a couple of years. So moving.
We have a question. I think that's Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, real quick, where would marijuana revenue find itself in these categories?
I would expect that to be in a selective sales tax.
Okay, thank you.
So turning, the last few slides I have are on the kicker and the reserve accounts. So I, just in case some people aren't familiar with the details of the kicker, right now For the past few years, we're down to having just a personal kicker. We still technically have a corporate kicker, but the surplus refunds from that don't go back to taxpayers. They get dedicated to K-12 funding. So most of the discussion these days is on the personal kicker.
Madam Chair, I don't mean to interrupt, and sorry, Chris, but I'm just wondering, is that the official logo for the Oregon kicker? I have never seen that before, so I'm just curious.
Does that sound like a nomination?
I've never seen one, so I guess it's in the lead, yes.
So the mechanics of the kicker, it's based on general fund revenue, and there are two pots. You have the corporate pot, which is the corporate income, excise tax, and then you have everything else, which is mostly the personal income tax, but it does include other revenue sources, estate taxes, some tobacco, some fines fees, and some liquor money, for example. And so with these two pots, every time there's a close of session forecast made, that sets the bar for the kicker. And as we go through the biennium with each quarterly revenue forecast, we're always comparing the new updated forecast with that bar to find out if a kicker looks like it'll be triggered. It won't actually be triggered until the end of the biennium, because what we have there is a comparison of that regular session forecast of what we think will come in according to the state economist forecast for the corporate income tax, and then everything else. And we compare those regular session forecasts with the actual revenue. And if actual revenue for each one of those two pots separately exceed that close of session estimate by at least 2%, then all of that revenue goes back to taxpayers. And again, that's on the personal kicker. And that can be modified by the legislature with a two-thirds vote. And that has happened a time or two, and that's the way, it's the mechanism by which the kicker is modified, and there is a bill that officially replaces the state economist's estimate for that close of session estimate, that figure. So just knowing that there is a mechanism by which the legislature can change it. I think the last time they changed it was in 2007 with the creation of the Rainy Day Fund. They modified that estimate to take the corporate kicker and use that. It was a little over $300 million to seed the Rainy Day Fund. So the kicker history, it was put into statute in 1979. It was a part of the vote of the public. And then it was moved to the Constitution in 2000. And at the beginning, the kickers were tax credits. The personal kicker was converted to a refund check in 1995, and it stayed that way until it was reverted back to a credit in 2011. Over the 20 biennia since the kicker was created, the personal kicker has been triggered 12 times. It was suspended once by the legislature. And during that time, it's about $5.3 billion went back to taxpayers. And the most recent kicker was just under $1.7 billion. And that went back on some recent tax returns.
Mr. Alanak, could you remind us, one of the challenges is trying to predict so far in advance what the revenue will be. And it seems like the numbers show us it's not quite half the time that we get it on target to such a fine, to below 2%. But can you remind us for the timing? It seems like I had been trying to think about it a few years ago, and you almost need to predict close to 2 years in advance what the economy will have done. But it's not only Oregon's economy, but national and global situations then impact our economy in certain ways. Is it about 2 years?
It is. And so to walk through a timeline, I don't have a chart on this. So for the 1921 biennium, we're in the last 6 months of that biennium, the bar was set, or that close of session forecast was made back in May of 2019. So if we go back in time to May of 2019, the state economist comes in and he presents to the legislature the forecast for the 1921 biennium in May of 2019. And so now that number gets fixed. And then you have whatever law changes the 2019 legislature made that affected the general fund get added on to or subtracted from that the May 2019 estimate. And so here we are in the summer of 2019, and the bar is set for the kicker. And it's on collections that will be coming in over the next 24 months from July 2019 through June of 2021. And that is a long time period. And I do have a chart that highlights that where that 2% threshold is, but that 2% is a pretty fine level. And it is challenging to hit that mark where the forecast is the within that 2% error range, if you will. The things that can affect it are varied. You'll have the uncertainty of the Oregon economy and the income tax over a 2-year period, and how our economy fits in with the overall U.S. economy, and any law changes made. Now, throughout the session, you'll be hearing some policies about how Oregon ties to federal law and what that may mean for Oregon when Congress changes laws. And Congress can change laws, and that can affect a lot of the tax collections, and that feeds into Oregon's tax collections, and none of those change that bar. So even with law changes being held fixed, it's just the uncertainty of forecasting an economy over 2 years. Now, most states just do this year at a time, and one of the challenges within a 2-year forecast is that second year, you can almost have a compounding error over the first year. So if you make an estimate in May of 2019, you don't get to come back in May of 2020 and adjust it for the biennium. And so whatever happens in the second biennium, it could almost compound the difference for the error or the difference between the actuals in that first year compared to what the forecast was.
And one final question. It seems that it's possible that Congress could make a federal tax law change that would cause Oregon to be wrong enough that Oregon then had to issue a kicker, but it was over something that we didn't actually make a choice about. Is that correct?
That is certainly possible. And I guess the example that comes to mind first is a while ago back in 86, where Congress changed federal tax law so that more revenue was coming to Oregon. A lot of the change back in 1986 lowered federal rates and expanded the tax base. And just to take a step back there, any tax consists of two pieces. You have a tax base, whatever it is that's being taxed, if it's income, if it's property, if it's a pound of marijuana, or if it's, you know, a pack of cigarettes, times the tax rate. And you'll be learning over the next couple of weeks, or we'll be getting into some details about how Oregon ties to the federal tax base. So it certainly is possible if Congress changes the tax law so that the tax base gets broadened, Oregon would be tying to that automatically, at least. And there are some assumptions that I'm making there, and bring in more revenue. In recent years, it's more often been the other case where Congress makes a tax law and through no policy decision, specific policy decision by the Oregon legislature, it negatively affects Oregon's income tax collections. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the big policy pull back and forth between the federal connect issue, just to a bit of foreshadowing there. So with that, these two charts, the one on the left shows the general fund trend. It's from about 1990. The solid line is the history, and the dashed line is the forecast from the December forecast. And it's oftentimes where the economy is growing is where we tend to have kickers, where the economy is growing faster than the assumptions built into the revenue forecast. So we have times here where this is the 2001 recession, this is a Great Recession. And also, each of these peaks here corresponds often with a kicker where we have a growing economy and the collections, the actual collections, keep outpacing the forecast. So we're issuing kickers. And then an event finally happens and we slip into a recession. And then it's not uncommon for that the first year of the recession to be to align with a time when we're issuing a kicker. That's happened in 07, 08, and it happened again this past year. And this is just the total amount. So you can see how the general fund has grown from about $5 billion in 89, 91. So this partly shows some sense of the question that I think Rep. Reschke had about 1990 versus 2018, where our general fund has grown from $5 billion to about $22 billion. The chart on the right is an attempt to show some of the another way to display visually the volatility in the general fund. So the black dashed line is the zero line. This orange bar is the average growth rate from 1991-93 to 1921, basically saying if you start with the general fund in 91-93, you grow it every biennium by what is about 11%. In 1921, you end up with that same amount. And so this represents kind of a fictional, if we had a very predictable growth rate in the general fund. The red line is the actual growth rate from year to year. And you can see some, or not year to year, biennium to biennium. In some biennia, the growth is over 20%. And other times, it's been a reduction of more than 5%, 5, 6, or 7%. Now, these are just dollars collected, so it's a collections perspective. So the kicker does come into play here, where in 1921, we were actually down biennium to biennium by a couple of percentage points. But if you adjust for the kicker, the growth rate is around 5%. And you can see in recent years where the growth has been pretty strong, where we've had growth exceeding 10% every biennium until recently. So the kicker and the 2% threshold. For the personal kicker, this shows the history of how hard it is to actually land within that 2%. I think we've had two biennia, 91-93 and 11-13, where revenue came in above forecast but below the 2%. And you can see here that the actual collections have come in anywhere from 10% above to about 12% below forecast. This chart, just for comparison, the corporate kicker is even more volatile. It has ranged from growth of about 70% to a decline of about 50%. And I would note just the x-axis here. On the personal kicker, we're going from plus or minus 15%, and on the corporate side, it's minus 60% to plus 80%. So the corporation tax is much more volatile for a number of reasons. It's an income tax. There are some 30,000 corporate taxpayers, 35,000, depending on how far you go back. But a lot of that revenue comes in from just a handful of taxpayers. But because the corporate kicker, again, just to remind folks that it is dedicated to K-12 funding now instead of going back to taxpayers. The second to last slide I have, I think, is the state reserve position. I will still talk to folks occasionally who have questions about whether or not Oregon has any kind of rainy day fund. And we actually have two. We have an education stability fund and a rainy day fund. And the source of the seed money or the source money for each of those is different. The education stability fund is seeded with money from the lottery. About 18% of certain lottery revenues go to the education stability fund. The rainy day fund gets a piece of the corporate income tax. Any tax collections that are above a certain tax rate go to the rainy day fund. And then also, any ending balance at the end of a biennium, the ending balance up to 1% of appropriations goes to the rainy day fund. And the RDF can be used for general purposes, whereas the ESF has to go to public education. And I would note, if draw your lines to the withdrawal line, this was an area where in this one of the special sessions this year, about $400 million was withdrawn from the Education Stability Fund and moved to the State School Fund to deal with the shortfall that had been projected with the May forecast. And under current projections, again, through the end of the biennium, so just the last 6 months here, if nothing changes, the ESF is projected to have about $427 million, and the RDF will have about $942 million. And so that this is a position where the state hasn't had the luxury of being in before. We're having fairly sizable reserve fund accounts on hand to deal with any budget needs.
Representative Reschke has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, real quick, deposits, is that by the legislature from the general fund putting into these particular funds? Is that where that deposit money comes from, or is it a different source?
No, the deposit, it's for the rainy day fund, it's the general fund, the corporate income tax and the appropriations, and the deposits for the ESF are lottery dollars.
Rep. Nathanson, this is Rep. Marsh.
Yes.
A question.
And by the way, I got a warning note across the top of my screen that we have 5 minutes remaining.
Okay. I just wondered if you would address the cap. I don't think you said anything about the cap on this chart.
So the cap, if we hit that cap, then the money gets diverted back to other general uses. And so that is something that we're watching. The Education Stability Fund, I think with the last forecast, was on track to hit that cap prior to the withdrawal of $400 million. So once the cap is hit, what those caps are for the ESF, it's basically 5% of the appropriations or the revenue from the prior biennium, and for the RDF, it's 7.5%. So those caps do grow with the size of the economy, if you will, or collections within the general fund. So each biennium, those caps do increase.
And follow up, Madam Chair, is that okay? If we approach the maximum, then would, for example, in the Education Stability Fund, the lottery dollars simply be up for reallocation?
Yes, they're reallocated, yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So with just a couple of minutes, I'll just put these up. To touch on some strengths and weaknesses of the revenue system strengths. And I've mentioned these throughout the presentation. The revenue growth is strong with the personal income tax because it's very responsive to economic growth. That's where in expansionary times, the general fund can grow quite a bit. The use of non-tax revenue reduces the burden on those income taxes. And that's just the part that where we talked about the shift from taxes to charges, so some of the other revenues. And the personal income tax is arguably better at addressing equity concerns in terms of ability to pay, because it can have a progressive rate structure where the tax rates can be increased, or the tax rates can be higher on higher income people. And that's an ability to pay concept. The fourth point here is the income tax system is tied to the federal structure. So the advantage of that is it reduces some administrative costs, in that we're not reinventing the wheel, so to speak. So that part is a positive. And then the last one, the charges leading to what economists call an efficient allocation, that's the benefits received principle, where the people paying for these certain services are the ones benefiting from those services. Oh, and local tax, the property tax is more stable over time. The weaknesses get into, it's almost often the other side of the same coin. The strong growth of the income tax, what goes up quickly can come down quickly. And so we have a reliance on an unstable revenue source for the general fund. And the high income tax rates, if they get too high, that can result, the reliance on the income tax and high rates can lead to a lack of diversity in revenue funds. That's the idea that all of our eggs are in one basket, so to speak. And then you have the potential, as those rates creep up, for various economic distortions. Reliance on the federal funds, you lose policy control. The advantage is that you can get that money, but it does come with strings attached. And the charges, the other side of the coin for the charges, is that it doesn't incorporate the ability to pay principle. And then the last item was something that was mentioned by Rhett Marsh, I believe, and the limitations of the local property tax, the local revenue system, with the limitations in place in the property tax, limit the growth of that, the revenue system there. And then that can lead to other kinds of outcomes. One of them would be local governments relying more on other charges. That was all that I had. So I will unshare my screen.
Thank you very much. This has been a really interesting briefing, and I've appreciated the way the information is being presented to us. Committee members, I think most of you have had the opportunity to ask a question or make a comment. Is there anyone else who would like to put in a final question or comment about today's topics? Yes, Rep. Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what would be helpful information in the future with these types of presentations is to get how much of these taxes have restrictions to them, like what they're earmarked for, or what their sidebars are, and what's ultimately up to, what's more flexible in terms of the legislature deciding where those funds can go, and if they can go to other funds, et cetera, or if they're restricted to a specific program, specific agency, et cetera.
Great, dedicated versus discretionary funds. Good point, thank you. Any other final questions or comments? We're just a couple minutes after our advised ending time. I think we're all right. I hear one other microphone coming on. Anyone else want to make a comment?
Madam Chair, this is Greg.
Yes.
You know, in regards to Representative Hernandez's question, it's an excellent one. It's also extraordinarily complicated, because $1 may be, while it's dedicated for a specific purpose, may get cut up into multiple slices to fulfill that purpose, but used in many, many different ways. And the best example of that would be the gas tax dollar, where while those roads are dedicated to highways, and highway preservation and development. There's many different ways highway preservation and development can occur. And so it'd almost be worthwhile at some point, and you know, obviously at your discretion, when we have that type of conversation, is to bring Ways and Means over so they could assist in that effort, because it really can get into the weeds.
Good point. Thank you. Someone who's used to wearing both hats of the money coin. Yeah. Thank you all for this really good first meeting. Thank you to all of the LRO staff who have introduced yourselves and been participating today. We look forward to working with you over the coming weeks and months. Mr. Alanak, is there anything else we need to do right now?
I think that's all we have right now. I'd be on the lookout for agendas for next week. We're trying to get those posted as soon as possible, as soon as we can.
That's right. I'll check in with the people I need to check in with and try to move that along. Thank you, everyone. We're adjourned.